This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the United States is at risk of slipping into authoritarianism, according to the author of the new book, Power Politics. Find out what could put us at risk and a list of solutions that could help preserve representative government. Now, the e-cigarette company Juul has agreed to pay over $400 million in a settlement after an investigation into the impact its marketing had on teenage vaping. The money will be divided between 33 states, including Wisconsin, which is expected to receive $14.4 million from the settlement. Teenagers use e-cigarettes at higher rates than adults, according to the University of Wisconsin's Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, with around 11.3% of teenagers using the products. The Centers for Disease Control says most e-cigarettes contain harmful and addictive substances, including nicotine, and that they're unsafe for kids, teens, and young adults. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you used e-cigarettes? Have you seen teens in your community, maybe in your school, maybe your own family, start vaping at an earlier than legal age? Do you have questions about vaping, how it's marketed, how it affects health? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Douglas Jornby is the Director of Clinical Services for UW's Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. He's also a clinical psychologist and professor of medicine at the UW-Madison Medical School. Dr. Jornby, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here. Thanks for asking me back.
And Thomas Carr is the Director of National Policy at the American Lung Association. Thomas, thanks for being with us today.
Of course. Thanks for having us on.
Thomas, let's start with you. Tell us about this two-year investigation into Juul's marketing. What were states worried about here?
Well, so state attorney generals have been engaged in a two-year bipartisan investigation into Juul's sales and marketing practices that directly led to the settlement you mentioned earlier with Juul by Wisconsin and other states. The investigation helped to confirm and document Juul's marketing practices that targeted underage youth. Their manipulation of the chemical composition of their products to make them more addictive and palatable to inexperienced users, and their misleading of consumers about the nicotine content in their products and the addictiveness of them as well, too. The Lung Association certainly commends the state attorney generals for undertaking this investigation and the settlement that resulted.
Thomas, what were some of the specific marketing practices from Juul? What a big player in e-cigarettes. What were some of the specific marketing practices that people looked at and said, yeah, that's clearly targeting teens?
They engaged in a few, and it was kind of at the beginning when they were trying to gain market share. A few examples of those are launch parties and events. They had a novel use of social media influencers. We hadn't really seen before, of the same age or older than youth. And then there were free samples that they gave out pretty religiously as well too. They also used the design of the product as well too as a marketing point, and the fact it was easily concealable. So my kids could use it in a concealed way in schools and other locations where they normally wouldn't be able to use it.
Dr. Jornby, let's turn to the teen vaping crisis. How quickly did vaping rise among teens after these marketing practices started?
Really dramatically. It looks from what we're seeing now as though it may have peaked in 2019, but it's hard to make too much of the data that we have from 2020 because there's so many other factors going on. But I think it's important to realize that among young adults, vaping was happening at four times the rate of traditional cigarette smoking. So it's tremendously more popular among young adults than old school cigarettes.
And I've talked to you and your colleagues in the past. We had these what seemed like years of good news where traditional nicotine products, tobacco in particular, the use had been going down among teens. And then we have this explosion of nicotine use among teens. This reversed a lot of our addiction progress over the years, right?
It did in terms of looking at, you know, actual use of nicotine. And we know, especially with younger people, like before the age of 16, using nicotine from any source can trigger a genetic variant that causes long-lasting vulnerability. So it's harder for them to quit. They have more severe withdrawal symptoms. But I think it's also important to note that given what we've learned over the last more than half a decade, that the risk of smoking traditional cigarettes is far and beyond anything we've seen with vaping products. So still some progress, but yeah, you're absolutely right. The switch from traditional cigarettes to vaping products was really fast and really large in magnitude.
Thomas, this settlement includes restrictions on some of those marketing practices that might target teens you mentioned. As I understand it, they'd already stopped doing a lot of that even before this settlement came out. Have you seen a change in focus from Juul and other players in the market when it comes to marketing?
Yeah, I mean, I think they did stop many of these sales and marketing practices that are banned under the agreement. And that was partly due to public outcry and FDA pressure. But I will say that it is useful that they're legally enforceable under this agreement, and so that does make a difference and could mean that Juul or even other products would not use these tactics again.
We're talking about vaping and teens and marketing. A new settlement from the company Juul gives money to states that had challenged their marketing, especially when it concerned teenagers. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing lots of vaping among kids in your community, maybe in your school? Have you run into this in your own family, your own classroom, if you're a teacher or a student? 800-642-1234 is the number to call with your experiences, your thoughts, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Want to listen to kind of a public service announcement here posted on UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention website about a teenager who became addicted to vaping.
My anxiety got really bad after I started vaping, and I was never an anxious person before. I started having panic attacks. I couldn't really breathe, like my heart was beating so fast. At first, I didn't think it was like addictive. I thought I was kind of stronger than it, but soon I realized like it was holding kind of a power over me. I was always craving more and more, like it was never enough.
Dr. Jorenby, we heard some of the effects on at least one person there. You mentioned vaping not as unhealthy as, you know, smoking cigarettes, but there are effects. Can you talk about the consequences, especially on teens?
Yeah, the biggest thing, and I think the most significant public health concern, is that there is evidence that young people in particular who start vaping, who get exposed to nicotine, who have never smoked cigarettes, are several times more likely to then go on and start smoking traditional cigarettes, which brings in everything that we know about the long-term effects on, you know, the pulmonary system, the cardiovascular system, the cancer risk, all the things that have been documented since the early 1960s. But certainly, you know, in terms of young people using that as a way to cope, and as Mr. Carr was saying earlier, you know, one of the things in the investigation that came through loud and clear was that at least in the past, Juul's marketing had not been completely honest in terms of the packaging, not making it clear that the Juul pods contained nicotine, or if they did, how much nicotine it actually contained. And that's really important because a lot of young people just aren't aware. They're focused on the taste, the flavor, the social experience, and not aware that they're rapidly becoming dependent on nicotine as a substance.
Thomas, the settlement of $438.5 million sounds like a lot. Divided among 33 states, divide that over a 6 to 10 year period. What is that money going to be used for? Is it enough, you think, to be helpful?
I mean, I think certainly my understanding of Wisconsin law is that I'll talk about Wisconsin first, but my understanding is that money from settlements like this would generally be deposited in the state general fund, although there could be some stipulations about how it's to be used in the final settlement agreement between the Wisconsin AG and Juul, which I think is being written over the next few weeks. It's hard to say why this amount was settled on, being on the outside looking in negotiations between the two parties. But certainly the lung association position is that all the money from the settlement in both Wisconsin and in other states should be used on vaping prevention and education programs to help further reduce vaping and tobacco use by kids. Given the source and context of the settlement, it would be the logical thing for the money to be used for.
And Thomas, you are with the Lung Association. What are your main concerns, or I guess let's flip it around, what are your main hopes for lung health for teens if we can turn the tide on vaping among them?
I mean, I think it's really e-cigarettes are the most used tobacco product among middle and high school students right now. And I think just Dr. Jornby said, there's a crisis of nicotine addiction out there amongst youth. And we're seeing them becoming more and more addicted. And that's partly a result of Juul's the additional nicotine and also how the chemical composition of the products, how that was changed and how they actually developed a new way of nicotine of basically the way the nicotine was ingested that made it easier for it to become addicted and easier to smoke. So I think the result to be that tobacco product use among youth is reduced to a minor public health problem.
And Dr. Jornby, I've talked to you in the past about smoking cessation. Do we know yet what works best for teens who are addicted to vaping? Do we have good tools in the toolkit to help them stop?
Yeah, well, to take that in a narrow sense, the honest answer would be no. At this point, still trying to come to grips with what's involved with vaping, we haven't had what would be considered the gold standard, randomized controlled trials of different treatments, which probably are going to need to be a combination of medication and behavioral approaches to help anyone, but particularly young adults, stop vaping. Those studies have not yet been done. At the same time, we know that what's most difficult when people are trying to quit vaping, as is the case with cigarettes, are the symptoms of nicotine withdrawal and the craving, the urges that people have to get that next dose, the dependence that nicotine creates when people use it regularly. And we do know that we've got a range of medicines and we've got some proven behavioral techniques that, while they're not perfect, they increase people's chances of quitting by 2 to 3 times over just trying to tough it out cold turkey. So those kind of would be the go-tos for anyone who's thinking about quitting vaping but hasn't been able to do it just by putting down the vape device.
We're talking to Dr. Douglas Jornby, Director of Clinical Services at the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, and Thomas Carr, Director of National Policy at the American Lung Association. They're with us today to talk about a more than $400 million settlement with e-cigarette company Juul over their marketing to teens and the health impacts of vaping, especially among young people. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've tried vaping, what did it do for you? Did you come into vaping from not smoking anything at all? Or did you go from smoking cigarettes to e-cigarettes? What questions do you have about vaping, about the marketing surrounding it? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Dr. Douglas Jornby, Director of Clinical Services for UW's Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, and with Thomas Carr, Director of National Policy at the American Lung Association. They're with us to talk about the teen vaping crisis and a new settlement in the lawsuit against e-cigarette company Juul over their marketing, especially toward teens. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you use e-cigarettes now? Have you in the past? What got you started? Was it your first foray into nicotine, or did you try it as a way to stop smoking traditional cigarettes? Do you have questions about e-cigarettes, how they're marketed, what they do? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Sue is with us in Madison. Sue, hello.
Hi. I was calling because my son, who is 30, is very addicted, and he got addicted as a teenager. And I'm wondering if there's going to be any help for him through these monies that have been freed up.
Sue, thanks for sharing your son's story. Thomas, as you said, it might be different from state to state and how we do it. Are you hopeful that some of the settlement money will go to help people like Sue's son quit?
Certainly. I think that's a very legitimate use of the money. It is part of some of the programs that I was talking about, too. Both the trying to prevent youth from starting in the first place, but also on services to help existing e-cigarette users quit.
Sue, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Dr. Jornby, do we still have that the tobacco quit line here in Wisconsin? I know I've talked to you about that a zillion times in the past.
No, but it's good that you do, Rob, because every time we say it, somebody else will hear about it. And my hope would be that's something that Sue's son can make use of too, because that is a service that's available at no cost to anyone here in the state of Wisconsin. It provides individual counseling over the phone or via text. It provides over-the-counter medication, nicotine patches, gum, or lozenge for 2 weeks for folks who are ready to make a quit attempt, and they also have specific materials oriented around vaping as well as traditional cigarette smoking too. So my hope is if he is interested, that's something he could use to support him in making a quit attempt.
That number is 800-QUIT-NOW. I just looked it up. You can do what I did and search for Wisconsin Quit Line. Again, 800-QUIT-NOW. If you want to join the conversation about vaping, that 800 number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Thomas, I know a big part of the story early on was in flavors, flavors often seen as marketed towards kids, candy flavored vaping and that sort of thing. What have we seen develop with that over the years?
Well, I mean, Juul was actually sold in a number of flavors prior to, so when it first got started in 2017, and that was certainly a big driver of the youth vaping epidemic, and in addition to some of the product features and other things like that. And then once there was some public outcry, and Juul now sells their products only in menthol and tobacco flavored. And what we're seeing is actually a move away from Juul among kids, and kind of they're sort of dropping to the sidelines, if you will. And then there's we're seeing kind of a move away from pre-filled cartridge type e-cigarettes like Juul and towards single-use disposable e-cigarettes like the company Puff Bar, which is now the number one e-cigarette product used by kids. And the one common denominator is certainly flavors in that. And the single-use disposable variety is coming in a wider variety of flavors. And part of that's due to basically Puff Bar and a number of other companies are claiming that they use nicotine derived from a source other than tobacco in their products. And most often in the form of a synthetic nicotine, which is derived in a lab. And until recently, this was outside of the jurisdiction of FDA Center for Tobacco Products. I may talk more about FDA oversight on these products later, but the products have been using this loophole to evade all regulations that are placed on tobacco products that contain nicotine derived from tobacco.
Thomas, can you remind us what were some of the regulations that changed? The FDA really did step in a big way with regulation of e-cigarette products.
Yeah, under a law passed in 2009, FDA has comprehensive authority over the manufacture, marketing, and sales of tobacco products. The authority initially only covered cigarettes, smokeless, and roll-your-own tobacco, but was expanded by FDA to include e-cigarettes and most other tobacco products in 2016. Unfortunately, FDA due to some self-imposed delays in implementing parts of their authority over e-cigarettes, they've actually largely been sitting on the sidelines as Juul and now other e-cigarettes were targeted towards our kids. FDA is now conducting a review of all e-cigarettes, including Juul, to determine if they should remain in the market. It's a process that is supposed to occur before a new tobacco product actually enters the marketplace, actually, so a little delayed. Juul's tobacco and menthol flavored products are part of this review, and they remain under review by FDA right now. But given Juul's role in the youth vaping epidemic, the Lung Association thinks FDA should remove all their products from the market.
Dr. Jornby, I want to talk about research into vaping. It seems like it's been here a long time, but I remember it wasn't that many years ago I saw my first e-cigarette in the studio I'm standing in now. A guest kept ducking under the console. And a poof of vapor would come up, and it wasn't tobacco smoke. I finally figured out he was ducking under and vaping. So it's fairly new stuff. What do we need in the research? What do you want to know that we don't know about vaping right now?
That could easily fill up half an hour just in itself. But I'll hook it to something Mr. Carr was talking about a few moments ago, and that is there's an ongoing tension in addition to the fact that this is a constantly moving target, and the loopholes that he mentioned that companies were exploiting. You know, the feds did step in and they banned tobacco and nicotine products for people under the age of 21, and they banned flavors. And yet we've got Puff Bar out there with synthetic nicotine, with, because it's not a cartridge, it's a disposable, it was going through the loophole on that. And it seems all very simple and straightforward to look at the egregious examples of companies marketing flavors, you know, based on sweet cereals and candies and things that really seemed aimed at young people. And they are. We know that's a really big factor in young folks starting to use them. But it also turns out that, you know, longtime smokers who might derive some benefit from using e-cigarettes as a way to quit combustible tobacco, and that's still a little bit up in the air in terms of whether that's reliable or not, but it appears that they also appreciate some of those different non-tobacco flavors. So steps that we take to protect young adults from starting in the first place, they may actually have some downside in potentially helping established smokers get cigarettes out of their lives. So it's not a simple thing, and we're trying to walk that line as fine as we can.
We'll leave it there. Dr. Jornby, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
And Thomas, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks very much for having us.
I've been talking to Dr. Douglas Jornby, Director of Clinical Services for UW's Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, also a clinical psychologist and professor of medicine at the UW School of Medicine. And Thomas Carr was with us, Director of National Policy at the American Lung Association. We're talking about vaping, especially among teens, with this new settlement for a lot of states, including Wisconsin, from the e-cigarette company Juul, after a two-year-long investigation of their marketing toward teens. Still time for you to share your vaping story. What got you started if you vaped? What stopped you if you've stopped? You can tell us about it over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can always email ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, jails are designed to be secure, not deadly. But in some parts of the country, people are dying at alarming rates. In Louisville, 10 have died since last November. Today on 1A, a closer look at what's led to these deaths and the nationwide struggle to improve care for those in custody. That's coming up today at 6. Now, in a speech 1 week ago in Philadelphia, President Joe Biden outlined threats to democracy, including former President Trump, saying that Trump and extremist Republicans, he said, are seeking to dismantle America's democratic institutions and operations. Our next guest says there is a real threat, and he says the underlying causes of that threat started long before Donald Trump ran for president. You can join in at 800-642-1234. 1 week out, what do you think of President Biden's speech about threats to representative government in the United States? Did you follow the response from former President Trump? Do you worry about the future of elected government in the United States, about the risk of authoritarianism? Call in with your thoughts or questions for our guests at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Darrell West is Vice President of Governance Studies and Senior Fellow at the Center for Tech Innovation at the Brookings Institution. He previously taught political science and public policy at Brown University. His new book is called Power Politics: Trump and the Assault on American Democracy. Darrell, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much, Rob. Nice to be with you.
Your second chapter is all about why to be worried. Some people might think, okay, yeah, we did have an attempt to overturn the presidential election of 2020. We had the January 6th attack on the Capitol. We got through. We survived. We were tested, and we did okay. Why should they still be worried?
We still should be worried because we're facing a perfect storm of threats to American democracy. It's not just the things you mentioned, which, of course, are very problematic in their own right, but we're seeing restrictions on voting rights, poor institutional performance, a toxic information ecosystem, the use and threats of political violence. But the real problem is we're not solving the basic problems facing our country. You know, income inequality is at a 100-year high. There's a loss of economic opportunity. There are all these culture wars. People are really frustrated with our system. When they're not doing well, they look for scapegoats. they turn to unconventional leaders, and we start to see people like Trump come forward.
You've got Trump in your subtitle, but you make a very big point that these problems that you just listed, and we'll dig more into them, these problems have been around for years. They won't go away even if Donald Trump retired from politics.
Polarization, extremism, and radicalization have emerged over several decades. And I do make the argument in the book that Trumpism is going to outlast Trump. Even if somehow magically Donald Trump retired tomorrow and never made another public utterance on issues of national controversy, Trumpism would still be there. The factors that enable populism and ultranationalism are still going to be there. The problems are really systemic in nature. Trump certainly has made the situation far more dangerous and more risky, but even if he disappeared, the problems would still be there.
One of the alarming statistics you cite is a growing interest in something other than representative government in the United States, people being open to the idea that maybe some sort of authoritarian government would be preferable to our system. Not a majority, but a growing number. What do you see? What do you make of that?
This is one of the things that actually shocked me the most when I was doing the research leading up to the book. I have a chapter on public opinion, and there have been several surveys over the past few years about the rise of authoritarian attitudes. And the exact number varies from survey to survey, but anywhere from a quarter to a third of Americans are willing to embrace undemocratic means. And ironically, young people actually are more likely to embrace non-democratic means. They're so worried about the opposition, like Republicans are worried that all Democrats are communists or socialists. Biden, of course, referred to his conservative rivals last week as semi-fascists. When people demonize the opposition in that particular way, they are willing to use whatever means possible to gain political power and to use political power once they have it and to keep the other side from coming to power. And unfortunately, this includes authoritarian means, the use of violence, overturning a popular rule. Like there are states that have basically enabled their state legislatures to decide which set of party electors get sent to Congress as part of the Electoral College. There's a lot of worrisome trends developing in public opinion that could turn the United States towards a much more authoritarian government.
You also point toward a concern about minority control of the government. Are institutions not representing people well? I'm going to quote here, one of the preconditions to an effective representative government, you say, quote, is fair representation in political institutions and some correspondence between public opinion and public policy, as long as the policy does not endanger basic rights. Institutionally, what are the threats to that?
Yes, and I should clarify that when we say minority rule, we mean rule by political minorities. So
right.
We're obviously not talking about racial minorities here, but there's a loss of majority control in the sense that if you look at House elections because of gerrymandering, like I think Democrats are going to have to win by almost 53-47% to regain or keep a majority control of the House. In the Electoral College, obviously, we don't have direct popular voting. One statistics that I discovered in doing research for the book was that if you look at all the presidential elections, 1992 through 2020, Republicans won the presidential popular vote only once. That was in 2004 when Bush beat Kerry. In every other year, Democrats have won the popular vote and then won the Electoral College and become president, or they've won the popular vote but lost the Electoral College and the Republican has become president. And so what this means is, even though Republicans have basically lost almost every presidential election over the last 30 years in the popular vote, they've actually controlled the presidency about 40% of the time. They're dominating national policymaking because of the filibuster a threat in the U.S. Senate and the need to get 60 out of 100 votes to pass basic legislation. It's hard for Democrats, even when there's a Democratic president, a Democratic House, and a Democratic Senate, to pass legislation. There are lots of pieces of legislation that are supported by 60 or 70% of Americans that are not being enacted by the U.S. Congress. So it's really the loss of majority rule that is very problematic. threats to representative democracy and just the fact that our system is just not functioning very well.
Talking to Darrell West about his new book, Power Politics, Trump and the Assault on American Democracy. Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. Jacob starts us off in Madison. Jacob, hi.
Hi. I'm really scared. I think that so many of the courts are stacked. So many of the state legislatures are stacked. We've got Republicans and libertarians in so many places of power in the country. Look at the last elections that have been happening across the states. There are so many people that believe what the rabid individuals on Fox News tell them, and the stuff online that is ridiculously just absurd. The conspiracy theories like QAnon, and it just makes me really worried, because I don't think people are thinking for themselves.
Jacob, thanks for the call. Darrell, Jacob brings up, let's go after his second point there, your concerns about misinformation and conspiracy theories.
Jacobs is exactly right. There is so much misinformation out there, and people are believing it. Obviously, we've seen the surveys where 70 or 80% of Republicans still think the 2020 election was stolen from them. We have anti-vaxxers, anti-mask people, climate change deniers. Like, for an era that is as scientifically and technologically developed as this one is, there's a surprising amount of misinformation and disinformation that's having real consequences. It's having public health consequences in terms of COVID, and then it's affecting our political system, because if people think the last election was stolen, it makes them more willing to think about doing unconventional things that could overturn majority rule in the 2024 presidential election. So there's been this steady erosion of facts in our process. People are developing their own facts, kind of regardless of the scientific evidence. And it just creates an information ecosystem that is incredibly toxic and dysfunctional.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Steve joins us next in Sun Prairie. Steve, hello.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I do find it ironic that your guest is talking about toxicity while he's providing nothing but talking points from the left. If we look at this objectively, what we're seeing is that we see people on the left, such as your guest, who point to people who view situations differently, and they view them as evil or stupid. There's actually a lot of nuance to every single one of the points the guest made. We don't have time to go through them. And if you want to talk about what the issues are, we have a media who won't call this out. That is the problem, and why the biggest threat to our democracy is a media that allows someone like this to put something out there that is so toxic without challenging back.
Steve, thanks for the call. Darrell?
Well, Steve will be pleased, I believe, by the fact that in the book, I actually condemn extremism on both sides. There are left-wing authoritarians out there that exist in American society, and there are right-wing authoritarians. But if you actually look at the public opinion evidence right now, there's a lot more right-wing authoritarians than left-wing by about a 4 or 5 to 1 margin. So I actually do worry more about right-wing authoritarianism, but it's because of the public opinion evidence. The fact that there's a lot more of them right now, it's skewing the process. The threats of violence, the domestic terrorism that we're seeing in many places around represent real threats to the process. So I try and analyze the situation as it has emerged over the last 40 years, think about what the risks are right now. And there are times where the left has certainly been guilty of lots of abuses. In the book, I do talk about social media problems. Twitter is actually dominated by liberals. And of course, it is a cesspool of falsehoods and so on. So Steve is right that there are problems on both sides, but some of the particular threats that we see to American democracy right now are actually much stronger on the right than the left.
Talking to Darrell West from the Brookings Institution about his new book. It's called Power Politics, Trump and the Assault on American Democracy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have concerns? Do you worry about the U.S. sliding to an ever less representative government, maybe into some form of authoritarianism. Do you have solutions, changes you'd like to see in laws, in the way we interact with each other? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with Daryl West about his new book, Power Politics, Trump and the Assault on American Democracy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have concerns about the future of representative government in the United States? What are those concerns? Do you have solutions you would like to see enacted here in Wisconsin, in the nation's capital, in the way we interact with each other in person and online? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Daryl, I want to talk to you about some of the solutions you offer in your book. One of them has to do with changing laws that you worry open the door to, you call them legal coups. First of all, what are the doors you want to close up, and what kind of changes do we need?
Well, you know, when people think about authoritarianism, they're worried about military coups and tanks rolling through the streets. I'm actually not worried about that. I don't think that is the real threat that American democracy faces. But in the book, I do talk about legal coups. One of the things that Trump did in 2020 was to find and reveal many of the vagueness and the vulnerabilities of the way we count votes, the way our elections are conducted. And so we need to clean up the vote process as well as the vote counting process. There are laws on the books that are very problematic. Many Americans don't realize that over the last few decades, Congress has passed a lot of emergency power declarations in a variety of different areas, which basically allowed the president unilaterally to declare a state of emergency in a particular area and basically to rule unilaterally. For example, if there's a border crisis, a president could declare that a state of national emergency and basically make decisions affecting the border without going through Congress. I find this very scary and very worrisome. Obviously, when Congress passed those laws, they assumed a president would basically be a responsible and trustworthy individual. We now know that's not always going to be the case. So one remedy is Congress needs to start closing some of those loopholes. They at least should add an ability for Congress to override a presidential declaration of a national emergency, just so we're not dependent on one individual. There's been a lot of attention to the Electoral Count Act of 1887, which basically governs how contested elections are resolved, how the votes are counted, the role the state legislatures play, and so on. There's a lot of vagueness, you know, the role of the vice president. You know, Trump tried to get Pence to unilaterally overturn the popular vote. Pence, to his credit, did not do that. But all those vaguenesses are still there. Congress has been debating reforms of that, and I pray that they actually do enact meaningful changes. But, you know, it's now 2 years after that election. We still have not seen any reforms of the Electoral Count Act.
In a sense, that's easy in the sense that we could pass a law to fix those. Another problem you point to seems harder to do. A lot of the motivation for candidates you write, politicians and candidates for office, is to anger their followers and appeal to anger and extremism, whatever side they're on. How do you change that incentive structure?
You're right that there are many appeals to fear, anger, and anxiety, and that drives a lot of the toxicity in American politics these days. And, you know, it's hard to change candidate behavior, and it's hard to change voter beliefs. But the whole point about political institutions is they are supposed to take the rough edges off of politics. They are supposed to act as a filter on extremism. Our current institutions and our current electoral arrangements are not doing that. And so we need some basic election reforms. One example is ranked choice voting, which we saw in the New York City race actually produced Eric Adams, who was among the more moderate of the Democratic candidates. We saw that in Alaska, where Sarah Palin was favored to win a House seat in a state that's pretty conservative because of ranked choice voting. She did not win that election. So it's not like we need to suddenly have our politicians acting responsibly, but if they work within institutions that basically encourage moderation and discourage extremism, then we're going to see fewer motivations to play to the extremes, and we will see more of a focus on problem solving and actually getting things done.
Talking to Darrell West about his new book, Power Politics, Trump and the Assault on American Democracy. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Nick is with us in DeForest. Nick, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you guys doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up?
So, you know, your guest speaker talks a lot about, you know, the disconnect and it having to be with the Republican side. And I feel that a lot of things have evolved from, you know, the whole stuff with Trump having classified information, and we want to make sure that we hold him accountable for that, right? And I agree 100%. Anybody that's in office that misuses their power or authority should definitely be held accountable. But to relate back to then, you know, Hillary Clinton at the time, we need to have fair across the field. So if one candidate or one representative is doing something wrong, there needs to be accountability across the field, and that's not happening. And the big thing, too, now going into, like, you're going into election season, corporations shouldn't have a say or be a major supporter of our electives. That's something that has definitely, you know, taken our elective politicians or whoever that are running for these positions out of
the... Gotcha, Nick. We just have a couple minutes. You brought up a couple big points there, and I want to give Darrell a crack at both of them. First of all, Nick says we need accountability when people break the rules or the laws, no matter what party they're from.
I would agree 100% with Nick, but I would make the argument that Hillary Clinton, for all of her indiscretions, what she did pales in comparison to what Trump has done. In taking the classified documents that he did to Mar-a-Lago, like documents that describe our human source intelligence agents around the world. There have been stories about the nuclear capabilities of various countries, and he took documents like that. That is far more serious, far more threatening to national security than missing emails that Hillary was associated with. So we need to basically make sure the punishment, if there ends up being punishment, fits the level of the crime.
Thanks for the call, Nick. Nick also brought up, Darrell, money in politics, corporations getting involved in politics in particular.
And again, Nick is completely right on that. Money in politics is a huge problem. I mean, in terms of income inequality, you have to go back 100 years to find inequality as much as what we have now. That inequality creates two very different, but both very important problems. One is on the wealth side, that wealthy people and wealthy corporations are trying to convert economic power into political power. And that's very abusive, and they're abusing their corporate power when they do that. But it also creates a problem at the other end in terms of working class people, the loss of the American dream, and the loss of economic opportunity. One of the things that is really fueling populism and ultranationalism is the fact that wages for ordinary people have stagnated for almost 40 years now. When people are not doing well, when they think their children are going to do a lot worse than they themselves did, they're going to look for scapegoats. Trump was very good at playing that game, pinpointing particular scapegoats, immigrants, minorities, women, and so on. That introduces kind of this zero-sum element into our political process that becomes very dysfunctional.
Thanks for that call. And Darrell, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rob.
That's Darrell West, Vice President of Governance Studies and Senior Fellow at the Center for Tech Innovation at the Brookings Institution. We talked to him today about his new book. It's called Power Politics, Trump and the Assault on American Democracy, and what he thinks can be done to protect representative government here in the United States.